Welcome to the Sinister Sisters podcast. I'm Lauren.
I'm Felicia.
We're best friends.
And we like spooky stuff. And it is my first day of summer vacation.
Woo!
After my first year of teaching. Woo woo. Indeed.
I'm so proud.
Oh, thank you. Oh, thank you. So yeah, I'm happy to be here and not be in school today. That's how I feel.
I was going to say, do you wish you were doing less work or more work?
Less, for sure. I think I usually, on a break, it takes me a couple days to, like, actually feel like I'm on a break for my, like, body to stop feeling like I'm working. And then I enjoy it for a few days, and then I get bored and have to do something else. So.
Totally.
I think I'll be good.
I think it's going to be great. I understand that feeling a lot. I feel like I don't know, maybe I do slightly better with doing nothing than you.
Yeah, I always wish I was better at it because I think I would be a more relaxed and happier person, but too bad.
Too bad. She's a high-functioning, anxious person.
That's right. That's right. But yeah, so anyway. I mean, I know you put on the tagline, I know now we're like weeks later, but the tagline for our last episode in the text, like the written portion, that the everyone on the submarine that I had covered last time is presumed dead. I mean, they're absolutely dead. And so it's interesting because we were kind of watching this tragedy unfold. And it was interesting in the description you had mentioned the baby Jessica in the well, which I thought was so genius because it was kind of that thing, except for they died. But just watching something like it's that happen bleak. In real time. Yeah. But to like watch something happen in real time like that was so crazy. And it kind of ended up being what everyone assumed had happened. So yeah, but it is sad and weird and complicated to discuss. I think there's a lot of perspectives on it, but it is, you know, no one deserves to perish like that.
No. Totally.
So it just sucks. But, you know.
I will say I have to give James due for bringing the baby Jessica thing up.
Oh, yeah. That's
because he always writes the copy for me. But anyway. But
he's so good
other
at it.
Than that, I he's was so going to say it. He's so good at it. He's so much better than me at it. I really hate doing it. And I'm like,
it seems
thank
so
you.
Professional every I give time him the facts. Like, damn, this looks good.
Yeah, he really does a great job. But I was going to say for the submarine thing, I will say it is maybe the better option of the two, that it was an instantaneous death. Like we talked about how horrifying to slowly, you know, run out of oxygen or, you know, any of that would be so terrible. So in some ways, very bleak, but better off that way in some ways.
Yeah, I think so too. I think so too. But yeah, so you're first this week, aren't you? Oh, wait, do we have recommendations?
Yes.
What do you got?
I don't have a ton. I was going to say I can't remember if I already said this to you, Felicia, but I watched all of that terrible Ultimatum show, but this time it's lesbians.
No,
it's amazing.
I watched it because you told me about it.
Yes.
Okay.
Is it so good?
Did love it. It was so chaotic. And then also watching the aftermath of when the one person was like, yeah, but you also like were throwing things at me and like domestic violence. I was like, oh, what? And then, of course, my entire TikTok just turned into stuff about the ultimatum and, like, the cast members and everything. Oh, my gosh. It was so crazy. But I do want to know, sorry, everyone who's lost right now because they didn't see the show, but who was your favorite couple on the show or favorite person on the show? Who was your favorites?
Yes. So I'll just start out by saying I think I'm team Mal all the way for, like, whole season favorite.
Oh my gosh. I do you like don't? Mal a lot. No, yeah, I like Mal.
I just thought Mal in the conflict with Yoli, I was like, I want to be more like Mal in my conflict in my life.
Seemed to be a very good communicator, but it was sort of this thing that I always had this question about was like, and this is always my thing with reality stuff, where I'm like, who are you on and off camera?
Yes.
You know what I'm saying?
100%.
Al, are you this good of a communicator behind closed doors? Or are you like, I don't know. Maybe they are.
Yeah. No, I totally hear you. Because I also was like, but there was just like one moment where like Yoli was like, I just don't know. I love Xander. I love you.
I know.
And Mal was like, you know, I understand that. Take the time you need. Figure it out. I mean, and I was like, wild. I would never thing do that.
I would never. You're right. I would never. I would never be like, yeah, how about you just figure it out and see who you love more? No. I would be like, I'm taking us both down. Like,
yes.
Yeah. So there's no way I could have done that. But
especially after you'd been with them for that long.
Oh my God. Totally. Totally.
And then Yoli's like, I've been dating Xander for 3 weeks and I love them so much better than you. And I'm like, well, yeah.
Oh my God. Because they're new and shiny.
Yeah.
But I do really like Xander and I hope Xander finds happiness.
Yes. Me too. I think Xander, like, I felt so bad for Xander being with Vanessa. I was like, oh,
okay,
gosh.
Well, obviously the show made Vanessa the villain of the series, but obviously she deserved it. She is
honestly,
so
yes.
crazy. Like, she is, I did not, I, the thing she would say, I was just like gasping at my TV. I was like, you know you're being filmed.
Me too.
Like, I just couldn't believe it.
I know. And again, speaking of like, don't you think like she must say more horrible things off camera?
Oh, that's probably definitely true. When they went, okay, at the dinner, when she was just looking at Xander and being like, fuck you, or fuck off, or whatever she was saying, I was like, God, that is insanity. Like, I was like, how, in what world are you at a dinner with a group of people and you are saying that to your partner across the table? Like, that
and
is
how do you stay
horrifying.
With that person?
I don't know.
And or, like, how does that person ever, like, have love
I was
for
like,
you?
Yeah. I don't know. Oh, my God. It's so crazy. It's so crazy.
It's the best show, I really think. Did yeah, you have a favorite? Do you have any favorite couples moments?
Yeah. So I did – I even though, you know, maybe she stars in drama, but who I really love is it Lexi?
Yes, with the big boobs.
Yeah. I do really like Lexi. I just like that she was just like, I don't know. She's just the kind of person that's like, I don't know what her birthday is, but she makes me think she could be a Sagittarius where she just is, you know, a fun person to be around, but then will just say something so truthful and dark that you're just like, wow, way to really like throw off the moment because she just can't help it, but just like say the truth, even if it's like something nobody yes. wants to hear. I just like that about her.
I loved Lexi. The only part I could not handle is when Lexi was like, Ray, you're going to have to tell my grandfather how you fingered Vanessa.
That was bad. That was toxic. I was like, oh, yeah. That was bad. That was bad.
I was like, wait, why? Why do you have to tell your grandfather?
Why do you have to tell your grandma that? But yeah, it seemed
but
also like when I was looking at stuff later, it just sort of seemed like people – like, the cast wasn't really following the rules of the show, which I think also, like, yes. added chaos. Like, they weren't supposed to be, like, talking to each other or texting each other. Like, and normally on these shows, like, don't they, like, take away their phones? But they didn't on the
I
show.
I thought so.
I don't know. So it got messy. This is a long conversation for somebody that is listening that potentially has no idea what the show is.
I know. We should probably move on, and then you and I can have a friend phone call where we just hash it out.
Yeah. Totally. Okay, cool. So are you going first? I don't really have any recommendations.
Yes.
Sorry.
I know. I'm like, I feel like we filled so much of it. I was only going to say I watched the first episode of Black Mirror, and I did enjoy it, but I don't know. I got to try again.
I started watching it, and I was like, eh.
Yeah. What is that?
I don't know. I thought it was – it just seemed so false. Like something about –
and kind of forced.
And I love Annie Murphy. I love her more than anything. But something about like the acting in it, I was like, this feels – I don't know.
Totally. I'm with you. Yeah. It just didn't feel quite right.
Yeah. But yeah. Okay.
All right. I'm going to jump in.
Jump in.
So this week I am doing a haunted house in Hawaii, actually. So this house is called the, or I guess like the kind of the name of the story is the Kasha House of Kemukai or Kemuki. And the house once sat in Honolulu, Hawaii, and it was even like built on a foundation of lava rock. So like my, you know, stereotypical idea of a real Hawaii house.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But everything began back in 1942. So a couple and their three children moved into the house, and pretty soon after they moved in, the neighbors started to worry because they could hear, you know, loud noises and crashes heard from inside the house. They honestly thought it was like domestic violence or kind of bad situation. Yeah. So neighbors actually ended up calling the police one night when it got to like a bad enough level or the sounds they heard. Which now in my suburban neighborhood, I'm like, this could be a real thing. I have nosy neighbors. Like they could, not on me, but I could call the police on someone.
Oh my gosh, totally. Yeah.
But the police officers, when they got there, they entered the home and allegedly, this is kind of similar to, oh shoot, what was that one you did a while ago where like the police report talked about paranormal activity?
If I could remember a single topic I had ever covered, that would be good.
It was the one that the movie was based off of, maybe Spanish subtitle movie.
Oh, Veronica?
That's right. I think so.
Yeah, I just can't remember the name of the actual family. But yeah, it was about the movie Veronica is based on the, yeah.
Yes, this kind of reminds me of that where it's like, it's just so freaky when, you know, in police reports, you actually like see mention of supernatural things. So in this one, the officers entered the home and they found the three children in the house. So it was a 10-year-old boy, an 18-year-old, and 20-year-old girls. So a little boy and then two like teenage early 20 girls. And they were all levitating. And
what?
I know. So they were all levitating and being attacked by some kind of unseen force as they were thrown around the room. So the woman or the mother was beside herself, you know, like freaking out, throwing Hawaiian salt to ward off the ghosts. And she kept repeating over and over, she's trying to kill my children.
Ugh.
So pretty intense. So it lasted for nearly an hour and a half, which is crazy to me. Like that feels like so long.
That is a very long time.
So this was going on for an hour and a half before the police were able to finally help the family escape. So I'm like imagining them like forcibly dragging them out. There wasn't much more detail than that. But the family ended up staying at the mother's sister's house and just didn't end up going back to the house for any real length of time. But the incident had begun at 10 p.m. that night when the little boy said that he smelled something bad that he identified as the odor of ghost. So I don't know how he knew what a ghost smelled like, but that's what he said.
Was it like the sulfur smell that we hear about in some of these stories where it's like it smells like something burning?
I assume so, which is freaky.
Yeah.
But it seems like – so he – like when he brought up the smell to his family, it seems like that like made the ghosts angry enough that they started to attack the boy and started to make attempts to strangle him and his sisters. So this whole experience was later written about in the local paper, and the mother actually says that I don't know at what kind of timeline this is, but said that the father had left the family, and so she blamed him for like why the ghosts like started to attack in that way. So the ghost is believed to be a Kasha, which is a ghost originating from Japanese folklore. And the actual translation of the name, this is kind of weird, but the translation of the name is fire cart or burning chariot, which Whoa. I don't know the real history of it. But basically, these ghosts tend to disguise themselves as house cats or strays. And their true form is a creature that walks on two legs and is bigger than most humans, ringed in the flames of hell.
Oh, okay. Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Have you ever seen the Japanese film House or Houseu?
No, but maybe this is it.
Yeah, because it's from the 70s, but – and it's a ridiculous movie, by the way. It's like the weirdest movie I've ever seen. But the poster is of a cat, And
ooh.
And what did you say this is called again? Kashi? What did you say?
It's Kaimuki. Yeah, Kasha House of Kaimuki.
Oh, I don't know. So I don't know if those two things are related, but for some reason they feel related in my brain. So I'm curious if any of that's connected.
Oh my gosh,
but,
they, it's so weird. It's not. I just looked up, like, it doesn't have not. Kasha in the... No, but it seems like it should be.
Okay. Maybe I just connected the cat with the Haosu and the Japanese, and my brain just put all it together. But not related. No, sorry, audience.
No, I hear you, though. Like, I'm looking at this movie, and I'm like, this feels like it has to be related. Yeah. Anyway. I guess not. But, yeah, so this creature... Some stories say that, like, these ghosts will steal corpses, you know, from funerals, cemeteries, crematoriums to eat them. Others say that they are demons that swoop down from the sky to nab the bodies of evildoers and drag them to hell as punishment. So kind of a freaky Japanese spirit is what they believed this to be. So they move out of the house. That's kind of the end of, like, their story. But 3 decades later... So I always wonder when there's, like, gaps like this. I'm like, did anybody in the house in the in-between have anything happen to them? Not sure.
Mm-hmm.
But 3 decades later, so 30 years later, 3 younger women shared this house, the same house, and their paranormal experiences began with strange noises, kind of escalated to them actually having, you know, physical feelings or having physical things happen to them. So one of the girls had a feeling of a hand on her arm, and it freaked her out bad enough that the women called the police and decided to spend the rest of the night at one of their mother's homes. So they asked a police car to be sent to escort them, and so they got into their car, and the policeman was, you know, going to follow them. And as they drove away, one of the women felt an unseen force strangling her. So the girls pulled over into a parking lot. The officer jumped out of his car, reached into the girl's car to help, and he was reportedly stopped by what felt like a large calloused hand, which is just so gross. Mm. But he said later that there's no way that it could have been one of the girls. Like, it was a much bigger, you know, obviously kind of gross hand. And so this invisible hand twisted his arm, and he kind of, like, ran away, and it prompted him to radio for backup. Then an answering officer arrived, and the first cop said, "There's a ghost in that car," and he was as white as a sheet, supposedly. The girls were hysterical as well. But this reporting officer told, you know, the girl who had been choked, "Here, come into the police car. I'll follow, you know, the other two of you to where you're going." And as soon as this girl gets into the police car, the motor died, and it wouldn't start up again. So he takes her back out, puts her back into the girl's car. The other officer tried the motor, and it immediately started now that she was out of the car. So the two cars drove about 5 yards, and suddenly the door of the girl's car flew open. That same poor girl that had been strangled fell out onto the road. And again, she was, like, tearing at her throat, like, you know, acting like something was choking her. And together, like, the two policemen were not strong enough to pull her hands away from her, like, from, like, pulling at her throat. And so rumor has it, and this, you know, this was all in the local newspaper, but this hasn't been, like, corroborated by the police. But the rumor has it that the only thing that stopped the spirit was the officer used water and Hawaiian salt, which, if you remember, that's what the mom was also using. So I think it's, like, you know, something that's in their culture, you know, some kind of folklore about it, but stop the spirit finally. So again, like, I think the girls pretty quickly moved out of the house, and that was, like, their most intense experience there. So these, you know, it's always crazy to me when these stories are, like, in the local newspaper. So there are obviously, like, a few theories about how the demon came into the house. One is that there was a father who lived there before that first family who murdered his wife and children in his home. It's said because the bodies of the wife and son, I guess, I don't know if this is all true, but supposedly bodies of the wife and son were found buried in the backyard, but the daughter's remains were never found. And so there's, like, a belief that maybe, like, her spirit is the one that, you know, is attacking all of these people. There's another kind of local legend, which is about like a queer couple. So two married women, and one of them actually got involved with a man. And then her lover found out about her, like the man found out about her wife, and then killed them both and killed himself. So again, I don't know that those are like, I know, super dark. I don't know that those are like real facts at all, but those are all kind of like what people say, you know, brought the spirit into the house. So I looked and I could not find anything that was like a real like movie about this story. This woman named Hannah Lee Epstein wrote a play about the house, which, you know, we love a spooky horror play. And it was called The Kasha of Kemuki. And it was actually presented by the Kumokahua Theater. And I want to say that that was in, yes, it's in Hawaii. It's in Honolulu, this theater. So they did produce it there.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, very cool. And then obviously, you know, I always love to like see if I can find anything else out about it now. So the house was actually demolished back in 2016. So there is a new house that stands on the property now. And then just for fun, I did find one more story that I'm going to tell that's on overlyopinionated.com. Hilarious. So again, take that with a grain of salt.
I hope it's just one girl's website that she's just like, here are all of my opinions.
We actually should both Lauren's start website. One. It's me. I wrote this. But it's from someone who lived in the new Kaimuki house that's been there, you know, since 2016. So him and his roommates had like made this kind of rash decision to move into the house just like through a series of like, you know, personal unfortunate circumstances. And he honestly didn't even realize that it was like a haunted house until he was like changing his address online and remember that there had been this story, I guess, about all this paranormal activity there. So they decided as roommates, like they weren't going to do any, you know, Ouija board or trying to call out the spirit or anything. The landlord actually lived upstairs in the house. So they figured, you know, everything was pretty safe. This guy says he's a skeptic. He wasn't worried, but he actually did start to have supernatural experiences happen to them. Or it happened to him. So he would wake up every day at 4:33 a.m. His room would be ice cold and he would have a gut feeling just telling him that, you know, something was very wrong. And then following every time he woke up, the smoke or every smoke alarm in the house would beep once, which stuff that's like very, that always scares
very
me.
Very, very bad. Right? Time to go. Time to move. Time to run.
If you're waking up at the same time, like, I don't know. If I woke up at the same time and the smoke alarms all went off at the same time, like, how many times would you give it before you were like, okay, I gotta move?
I feel like three would be my number.
Yeah, right?
First time, weird. Second time, coincidence. Third time, no. Something's wrong.
So I agree with you. He said, you know, all the smoke alarms are all battery powered in separate rooms. He had no idea how they were beeping together. His room also had a portable AC unit and he would leave it on 72 degrees. And so he didn't understand how like every time that he woke up, it was at 60 degrees and it would just like turn itself on in the middle of the night and go down to 60 degrees, which is freaky to me too. And also expensive, honestly.
Yeah.
But his chest would be tight. He'd have a hard time breathing. Each time he would run out of his room and into the living room and then be totally fine, which I also think is like kind of even more freaky in some ways that it was like just in his room. And then basically the next night, everything would be back to normal. And he would, you know, have like a – like I guess even in the morning. He didn't say it would like continue on. So he actually says that he didn't think it was really like some kind of demonic presence, or at least to him anymore. He feels like it was just some kind of like, you know, trickster or like, you know, mostly peaceful kind of ghost. And none of his roommates ever had the experiences that he had. They never had anything weird happen to them. But he did eventually move out like when his lease was up, and there doesn't seem like there's anything else really about the house since then. But I thought it was really cool. And I the story of, like, the kids all levitating, like, the fact that that was in a newspaper is just so crazy to me.
Yeah, that's wild. And, like,
scary.
Oh, so scary. But such a visually striking image that I'm like, wow, that's crazy.
Yeah. And I'm surprised there hasn't been a movie about it or something.
Yeah, because it's not Houseu.
Mm-mm. That's I wish it was.
Lauren. That's a movie. I don't even know if I mean, I do recommend it, but it is one of the strangest. It's like almost, it's like comedy. It's very experimental, very, probably the weirdest movie I've ever seen. I'll say that.
I love it. I can't wait to check it out. I feel like I remember you talking about it at some point.
Yeah, I might have. I don't even know.
But I love it.
But it's wild.
Incredible. All right. Well, that's it for me.
Good job. Good job. Spooky.
Thank you.
Spooky. Okay. So today I haven't really done anything like supernatural in a while, I feel like. And I'm also not doing that today. So today I'm talking about wrestling. So my fiance Travis, yeah, his favorite thing in the world is wrestling. He's loved it since he was a kid. And I just asked him, I was like, do you have any, like, is there any, like, good stories I should cover about wrestling on the podcast? And he mentioned the murder of Bruiser Brody. So Bruiser Brody, his real name was Frank Goodish, which I think is a funny last name, like good and then I-S-H. So it's like, I'm good, but I'm good-ish.
Goodish.
Yeah. Frank Goodish. He was a former football player before he got into wrestling for Iowa and West Texas State. He was 6'5" and weighed close to 300 pounds of just like pure muscle. Like, this guy is a
big man.
Enormous. He is ginormous. And then he, after college and after playing football, he was a sports writer for a bit. He was a bouncer for a bit. And then eventually he found wrestling and he was like, found his like calling. So I don't know if Lauren or our listeners, I don't know how much you know about professional wrestling, but
not a ton.
That's fine. So it's very theatrical. So people have gimmicks, which I think in the theater world we would call characters, that they play. And the gimmick of Brody is very simple. Like, it wasn't something that is very, like, there are characters that are like, oh, this girl is a anime pirate. This guy is, you know, he's like playing a white trash character with a million kids. Like, Bruiser Brody, his character was that he was the toughest, meanest guy that's ever existed. Like, that was the character. Wow. He was just almost sort of caveman-like and unhinged, crazy long hair, big beard, these really like wide eyes that like somebody is like someone you would never go up to. Like, just automatically big no, I'm scared of you just by your very existence. And so he was what's called in wrestling a heel. So he was a bad guy, basically. But he wasn't a heel in what's the traditional sense now. So people are typically, and I'm sure if Travis listens to this, he's going to be like, either proud of what I know or embarrassed of what I don't. And I'm not sure which it'll be.
Proud.
Proud.
Be proud.
So you're either a heel or a good guy, or a baby face, which is also like a good guy, I guess. And typically people find those personas by their interactions with the crowd. So they're either kind of the hero and like giving the crowd what they want, or they're the villain and they're sort of taunting the crowd and kind of encouraging the crowd to hate them. And both are good positions to be in, because as long in wrestling, as long as you're getting a reaction from the crowd, whether good or bad, you're succeeding is kind of the vibe.
Makes sense.
But Bruiser Brody, he wasn't really concerned necessarily with engaging with the crowd. He was almost like, I don't want to say alienating them, but he was so into the like kind of insane guy character that it was kind of like he would be doing this whether there was a crowd or not. Like, that's kind of what he was going for. So some of the things he would do, he would bark like a dog. He would, he had a chain, like a giant chain that he would like wear into the ring that he would use to hit opponents. The main thing he was known for, which I think people used to do more back in the day. By the way, we're kind of in the 80s. I should have said that, which is sort of the height of wrestling until it's kind of had a big comeback recently. But there was called the blood trick that wrestlers used to do a lot, which is they would put a razor blade in their wristband. And they would make a very like light cuts on their forehead because heads bleed profusely. So I don't know if you've ever got a cut on your head, but it won't stop bleeding. And so they would actually make these like kind of micro cuts on their forehead so that throughout the match, blood would be pouring down their face and into their eyes.
Oh my God. Blood. I didn't know any of that.
Yes. Yes. And this was just a standard practice. This was just like, yes, that's how we put on a show here.
Wow.
It's wild. So he had been part of a lot of different promotions as things came and went. So he had done, All Japan Pro Wrestling, NWA Wrestling, WCW Australia, WWE, of course. Oh, wait, no. WWE didn't exist yet. See, this is where I'm going to get in trouble.
I think you're doing great.
No, it did exist. Okay. Basically, he did all the promotions that were around at the time. That's a guess. I don't know.
I'm sure it's right.
I'd check. But, oh, wow, there's just so many. It's like CSW, WWWF, WWC, DSW. I'm like, what does all this mean? Okay. Anyways,
wow.
But why we're talking about him today is that he had a very tragic death at a wrestling match backstage.
Ugh.
And it was interesting to me because the reason that he died and the lack of justice around it is very wrapped up in the sport of wrestling and how it's perceived by the public. 1988.
Mm-hmm.
Bruiser Brody is in Puerto Rico. He has a scheduled match. This is July 16th, 1988, with Dan Spivey at the Juan Ramon Lubriel Stadium. And it was in the city called Bayamon. Sorry if I'm saying things wrong. Which is near San Juan in Puerto Rico.
Okay.
So he's at this match. It hasn't started yet. When they had come from the hotel, they had the wrestlers themselves had a hard time getting to the stadium because there were so many cars, so much traffic. It was clearly going to be a sold out huge night for wrestling in Puerto Rico.
Mm-hmm.
And when they finally got in, they're in there for a while. And at some point in the evening, before the show starts, a fellow wrestler who was also a booker, who went by Invader One, his name is Jose Huertas Gonzalez, and mm-hmm. he was also a big wrestler at the time, especially in Puerto Rico. So he did wrestle in the U.S., but he was very big in Puerto Rico. So his career started in like 1972-73. He joined WWF, and then when he went back to Puerto Rico as this like, you know, kind of more professional wrestler, he took on a masked persona known as the Invader. And he is said to have done this because he didn't want his mother to know that he was a wrestler. I was like, how did she not know?
Yeah, how did
she not? Very confusing.
What did she think you were doing?
Yeah. And so he was actually a part of a tag team known as the Invader. So he was Invader 1, and then there was Invader 2, Invader 3. Anyways, so a lot of the like eyewitness accounts for this are so people that were there, and one of the biggest eyewitness accounts that you could listen to talk on Dark Side of the Ring, which is a Vice series where they like talk about like some of the craziest things that have ever happened in wrestling, is a wrestler named Tony Atlas. So he's sort of what I would consider the main witness in this.
Mm-hmm.
He apparently was in the dressing room backstage before the show, and he was drawing because he liked to draw, and Bruiser Brody came up to him and was like, "Oh, that's so amazing. Could you draw a picture of my son?" And so Bruiser Brody, he was married. At the time, he was married to his second wife, Barbara Smith, and he had a son named, I don't even know his son's name. It's terrible. I don't see it on the Wikipedia. Maybe we're not supposed to know. But he had a young son, and he gave him this photo and was like, "Can you please draw him?" And then while they were having that interaction, Jose Huertas Gonzalez, Invader One, says to Bruiser Brody, "Can I talk to you in the dressing room? Sorry, in the showers." Mm-hmm. So Bruiser Brody said, "Yeah, sure." He walks in there. There was some sort of argument, so people could hear them sort of fighting. And at some point, it got loud enough, and Tony Atlas heard some sort of very scary noise come from Bruiser Brody. And so he goes over, and then Bruiser Brody is doubled over, kind of falling out of the shower. And Tony Atlas said his immediate thought was that he had gotten like sucker punched, and he was like, "Oh my God." And you know, at the time in the 80s, from what I understand, wrestling on and off stage was just much more vicious. And mm-hmm. so even it wasn't as monitored as it is today, and like even like commercially monetized mm-hmm. in the same way. So, like, people were really like fighting over their spots in, I think, I guess sometimes physical ways. And yeah. So I don't know exactly. People say that Jose Huertas Gonzalez had some sort of long form grudge against Bruiser Brody. And yeah, they just had, I don't know, some kind of like longer standing issues going on between about booking, about wrestling. I don't know. And so Tony Atlas sees, after he's, you know, kind of grabbed onto Bruiser Brody, he sees Jose holding a bloody knife. And he's like, "Oh my God, you just stabbed him."
Yeah.
And so at this point, another wrestler starts pulling Jose back into the shower and kind of standing between them. And they all start asking for help. And so they call the police. The police don't come for over an hour. And there's sort of two reasons for that. One, because they had a hard time getting in because of the stadium traffic, which I know is like...
Makes sense. Like,
the second thing is that the Puerto Rican police were not sure if this was a real stabbing
or staged. Oh.
Yeah. Because so much of what wrestling was about and was monetizing was violence. And the crowds loved the violence. And they didn't know if this was just like a gimmick thing to create hype around the show.
Which is wild.
So they finally get there. And when Tony Atlas comes back into the dressing room, like they take Bruiser Brody to the hospital, and he hears people talking, and he realizes that people are saying in the dressing room to the police officers that a crazed fan came backstage and stabbed Bruiser Brody. Is the story they're giving the police.
Oh my God.
And
just
he
a lie.
Points right at Jose. I mean, I just love this. This Tony Atlas guy is great. He points at Jose Gonzalez and says, you killed, he's like, you stabbed him. The guy that did it is right here. He's sitting right here talking to you. So they didn't like that, obviously. And then there's another sort of dynamic going on here that we haven't mentioned, which is Americans coming in as workers on this event versus the Puerto Rican wrestlers and police. So there was also this kind of thing of like, who was the police going to believe? The Americans that they don't know, or like the hero wrestlers of their country? So that's bad. And then that night, somebody told Tony Atlas not to go back to his hotel room because he had talked to the cops, and apparently somebody told him, they're looking for you. Don't go to the hotel. And so Tony Atlas spent the whole night wandering on the beach, scared to go to the hotel, doesn't know where to go. So dark. Oh, I forgot to say something really important. And that is, after this happened and Bruiser Brody's in the hospital, the show went on.
No.
Scheduled.
I was going to ask you that. Oh my God.
Yes, everybody performed as they were supposed to.
They said it's all good.
They said money's more important than the stabbed wrestler in the hospital.
Oh my gosh.
I know. It's just insane. Yeah. Okay, so the story, once again, so the next day, Tony goes to the hospital and finds out that Bruiser Brody has died, basically from bleeding out.
Wow. Yeah. Because it took the cops so long to get there.
Yeah. So he died from his stab wounds. He had 2 8-inch cuts into him. His liver was sliced. He couldn't make it. He wasn't going to make it. So then they, of course, had to call his wife and say, you need to come to Puerto Rico. And she was like, why? And they didn't tell her why until she got there. And so she came there and they ended up having like the funeral in Puerto Rico. Yeah, it's just horrifying. So then Jose Gonzalez does go on trial for the murder of Bruiser Brody. But he tells the jury and tells whoever that he was acting in self-defense.
No.
And in 1989, he was acquitted of the murder. And this is one of the worst parts, is that all the witnesses, particularly the American witnesses, of the murder, including Tony Atlas, they got their jury, their, oh, sorry, not the jury summons. They got their summons to testify as a witness the day after the court acquitted him.
Oh my gosh.
So they basically were like, paperwork error. Sorry, we didn't call you in time to actually give your statement. He's already been acquitted. I guess you just didn't get the summons in time. Sorry.
This is wild.
I know. It's freaking horrible.
It is.
Yeah.
And shady.
It's so shady. And then, you know, Jose Gonzalez continued to wrestle. So let's see. Yeah, he wrestled in 2011. In 2012, he became a director of the World Wrestling League, which is the Puerto Rico wrestling promotion. In 2019, he wrestled at 73 years old. So he is like still a part of
out there doing it.
Yeah. A part of this world as though nothing ever happened. And it's just so dark and scary. Yeah, but the part that really kind of I was so interested in is this idea of like a group that is like monetizing violence, and then when real violence happens, they sort of don't handle it appropriately.
No.
And part of it seems to be because the show of it, and like the, and once again, like Jose Gonzalez was like considered a good guy, and Bruiser Brody was considered a villain. and him getting off for self-defense for stabbing him unprompted in a shower. It's just this kind of thing is like, is there characters bleeding into a trial, even though the characters aren't who they actually are? When Bruiser Brody was like, you know, a dad and like a guy, you know what I mean? Like who was right. putting on a character. And it does, and especially in the 80s and in the 70s, probably more so, it had pretty, I mean, the 80s by this time, people understood that wrestling was sort of fake. You know, like it's a show, it's theater.
Yeah.
But not fully.
Not as like, much as they do now. Yeah.
Yeah, not like now. Like it was still like, it was still more real to people. The characters and the violence felt much more real to people because the veil had not come back of like how these things are done. So
right.
it was just kind of a different time. But yeah.
Wow. That is the craziest story.
Yeah, the murder of Bruiser Brody. It just is so sad. And the fact that like no justice was ever done is horrible.
Just so upsetting.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, what a good wrestling true crime story.
I know. And unfortunately, it's not the only wrestling true crime story. If anyone's interested in that stuff, you should watch some Dark Side of the Ring episodes because wrestling is a very dark and twisted sport and has a very dark history of a lot. Like there, this is not the only murder, and this definitely not the only death.
Wow,
in the sport, and it's
how
just
effed.
Yeah, I know, right? But yeah, that's it.
Well, thank you for doing that. I thought that was such a good one.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Amazing. Well, thank you all for listening this week.
We hope you have some sweet, sweet nightmares.
Bye.